Good evening, everyone, and a very warm welcome. This is John Campbell introducing you to Miracle Hour on bbsradio.com. A very warm welcome to our listeners all over the world. And we had a little bit of a scare there. I'd forgotten the time difference. I'm back over in England right now. I just flew in from the States, just arrived in this afternoon. So I was a little bit skew-whiff with the timing there, but that's okay. We managed it just in time. As we know, everything happens in perfect timing. And I had a wonderful trip over to California, one of the states I absolutely love in USA, and had a great week over there meeting up with D. Patrick Miller. And tonight it's a great pleasure for me to introduce our guest for this evening, who's had a major part in the expansion of the Course in Miracles over here in England. And he runs something called the Miracle Network, who meet up in London on the last Thursday, I think it's the last Thursday of every month, and also do numerous other things, have a great magazine that comes out called I think it's called the Miracle Worker. And it's a great pleasure to introduce Ian Patrick, who's with us here tonight. Good evening, Ian.
Hello, John. You must be jet-lagged as well as everything else.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It's so good to be talking to you. And I always, most of my guests say they like it because it feels like they're just having a cup of tea. And that's the kind of place I want to drop down into with you. And it's amazing. You get in these rushing around, and I've just been out. I grabbed a bit to eat, and I suddenly thought, oh, it's going to be 9 o'clock. And I was just phoning Ian, folks, and letting him know that it'd be an hour later tonight, and suddenly it hit me that it's an hour earlier. So thank you for adjusting your schedule, Ian, and
no problem.
Hope that hasn't thrown you around too much.
No, not at all.
Good.
Nice to be with you.
So it's lovely to have you as well, especially coming back from where I've just been. And what I'd like to do is to get a little bit of a background. I always find it fascinating, you know, as I've said, I'm a very, very new student to this wonderful piece of work. And what I find fascinating is hearing how different people find the course, get their way to the course, you know. So would you mind sort of sharing with our listeners a little bit about your background before you got sort of into the conscious sort of spiritual stuff and what you used to do and then how you came to the course?
Certainly. Well, I began my adult life, I suppose, my professional life as a geologist working in the oil industry. And it's not that I was very successful at it, but I was earning good money and I was doing lots of travel and had a pretty good lifestyle. Bought an apartment in central London and paid off my mortgage and used to sort of lead the high life. But I always felt that
I know that one.
I always felt that something was missing. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, despite having everything. My life was full. I kind of felt empty at the same time, and I didn't realize that it was the search for spirituality or the search for God until some time later. But I remember it was someone from the same company that I was working for. I was walking through the park one day with him, and I kind of said, we were philosophizing about life, and I said, oh, there must be more to existence than this. You know, what are we doing this all for, and what's the point of it? And he said, oh, so-and-so in the office has just done this course. And he said, you know, he really rated it very highly, and it's changed his life. And I kind of decided at that point, knowing nothing about what it was, what the course actually was, I decided that I wanted to do it. Just sort of in the moment, just felt like the right thing. So I had a word with this guy in the office, and he told me a little bit more, and it was what it turned out to be. You're familiar with it. It doesn't exist under that name anymore, but it used to be called the EST Seminars.
The Forum,
That's right, the Landmark Forum. It wasn't that course, but it was very similar to that. So it wasn't closely related to Course in Miracles at all. It wasn't overtly spiritual. But it was people I met on that course who then later went on to promote a guy called Chuck Spisano, who people may or may not have heard of, but he's teaches, he's a workshop leader, seminar leader. Yeah, psychology vision, and he teaches from his experience as a psychologist and also his in-depth knowledge of A Course in Miracles. And so he was the first person I heard mention the name A Course in Miracles, and it pricked my interest. And I asked a friend of mine what this Course of Miracles was, and she said, oh, it's this book. And she passed me this big, thick book, and I took one look at it and saw the Christian language, which the course is full of, and immediately judged against it and thought, well, this is just Christianity. I'm not interested in that. Having kind of distanced myself from Christianity many years before, I didn't want to have anything to do with religion. Now, I didn't realize that it wasn't about Christianity, and it wasn't religious in the traditional sense, that these Christian words that the Course uses have psychological meaning. And
yeah.
It was quite a few years after that, I mean, not quite a few, probably 2 or 3 years after that, that the penny dropped, and I realized, because of the wonderful Marianne Williamson, who everyone does know, some of her work, and I started listening to her lecture tapes, and yeah, she explained what these words meant, and the penny dropped, and from that moment on, really, then the course was my path. It was like a coming home to me, really. It was like this is.
So did you actually?
Did you actually do the S program?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't S itself. No, it went by another name. It wasn't actually S, but it was a very similar.
Right.
Kind of. It was founded by somebody in the UK who had done Est, and he did kind of his own version of it.
Right.
Yeah. It was called Exegesis, but I don't suppose anybody's ever heard of that now.
No, I just found it interesting because so many people, interestingly enough, Gary Renard, that was his opening, was doing the Est program, you're probably aware, you know.
Yeah.
So really, you started to hear the name of the book, and then you went and got the book. And
well, the name, I was just, it's quite a curious name, really. I was curious about it, A Course in Miracles. You know, it sounded intriguing.
Appeals to the ego, doesn't it?
Yes, I guess so. but my funnily enough, it was my ego that reacted against it, having then seen it. Not only this language, but the size of it. It's quite a sizable book, and it looks quite daunting.
Yeah.
And of course, it is daunting to the ego.
Absolutely.
Well, I had that negative response to it, and still do sometimes.
Did you actually go out and purchase it?
I knew that these Marianne Williamson tapes were important, and they turned out to be important because it was. Because of them that I really, you know, first got it for this, as I say, the penny dropped, a light bulb moment. But also, yeah, I felt the book was important to buy, even though I didn't want to read it. So, like my friend, I just put it on my bookshelf. But somehow I knew
so many people, same story.
Yes.
And it just sat there, presumably.
Pardon?
It just sat there for a period of time, presumably.
Sat there for say 2 or 3 years until Marianne Williamson came along.
Right.
And again,
and all this time you were still working in the field, in the geological field.
Yeah, I was still working in the oil industry. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, if you want me to take the story further on to the foundation of the Miracle Network, that was a little bit curious.
Well, even before that, Ian, when did you definitively pick it up, you know, and say, right, I'm going to actually start studying this?
Well, having had this light bulb moment with Marianne, as it were, from that point on, really, I just recognize it as the most amazing, exciting, and potentially life-changing thing that I'd ever come across, and realized this had been what I had been looking for, even though I didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that moment on, I was a course student.
Right. And did you join a group?
Yes, I did. I went to a couple of groups and then started my own. And this is actually taking the story further on. And because I was a great fan of these Marianne Williamson tapes, giving a good advert tonight, I started firstly importing the tapes from the States and distributing them amongst my friends and contacts. And then I actually got a license from Marianne herself, her organization, to manufacture the tapes over here in the UK. I did that for a number of years and got developed a wide network of contacts through that. And then people started saying to me, Ian, why don't you do a Course in Miracles newsletter modeled on some of the newsletters in the United States? And my response to that was, no, far too much work, far too difficult, I don't want to do that. But so many people said it, that I suppose maybe the idea began to gel in my mind. And then one day, a friend of mine named Robert Holden, who's now quite well known in the States and worldwide, written numerous books on happiness.
The Happiness Project,
Yeah, he said to me, why don't we do a newsletter based on A Course in Miracles? Now, I knew he'd had experience in publishing, and I think he was deputy editor or assistant editor to a spiritual magazine. So he was the first person who said we, rather than why don't you do it? He said, why don't we do it? So I immediately said yes. And then he then disappeared for about 6 months because he was terribly busy. But I guess I'd made that commitment. So I said, yes, I would do it. There was a couple of other people around who helped me, and we published the first issue of the Miracle Worker magazine a newsletter, we called it then, later became a magazine, in November 1994.
Wow.
So
14 years.
Yes, 14 years.
Mm. Well, and again, all this time, you're still holding down your job in the oil industry?
Yes, I think I'm not sure. I've lost track of time, rather like you, actually. Lost track of the years. I'm not sure how many years I was doing the two things in parallel. At least 4 years, I'd say. I think I gave up working in the oil industry in about 98, but I'm not sure. It might be 97 or 99. Pardon?
Sorry, Ian?
Sorry, I lost what you said then.
I was saying, what would fascinate me is, can you tell me, would like to share what happened, Did you notice did it affect the way you interacted with your colleagues and your work colleagues in the oil industry? Because by this time you're already reading the text and doing the lessons, presumably.
Well, I think it had an effect on my life in general, not just specifically with my work colleagues. I think it gave me a context for my life. Suddenly, a lot of the things I'd questioned in my life and some of the thoughts I'd had as a young child about God and even the nature of reality, I had some amazing thoughts as a child. They were kind of confirmed by the Course. So it was very affirming and just created this kind of overarching context for my life that I realized that everything that happened in my life happened for a purpose, that I could, I could choose the purpose. I could choose it for the ego's purpose to keep me stuck and keep me in pain and turmoil and all the rest of it, or I could use what happened as a learning and as a growth experience.
Yeah.
So I think right from the word go, my life changed.
But did you actually come out of the closet with anybody at work, so to speak, or
one or two? I don't think I never regarded the Course as something that I need to go around sort of preaching about. It's how I think and it's how I carry myself. I think it's very much an internal thing. I'm sure other people sense it. There's something about you. I mean, hopefully, if you're experiencing inner peace, which is really one of the goals of the Course, then other people are going to pick that up.
And that's more what I thought. I wasn't imagining you go around preaching, but I was more thinking people asking you, what are you doing? You like, I know that's happened to me. What are you doing? Something's changed, you know?
I don't recall any work colleagues in the oil industry asking that, but I do know friends of mine detected a difference. People said to me, oh, you seem very happy, or you're happier, or, yeah, I mean, they made comments like that. For sure, yes. So it was nice to get an external kind of affirmation of that internal change. But I think primarily it's about what happens inside me and how I felt different. Yeah. You know, even if nobody else had noticed, it really wouldn't have made any difference.
Yeah. And I mean, did you find that a lot of people talk about, and I certainly experienced this, Ian, that in that first year, there's a lot of stirring up. It's not all sort of sweetness and light, is it?
Well, I still find that.
Yeah.
I still find that.
That's good. Oh, that's good to hear that.
Yeah. Well, there is an argument that that it actually gets more difficult as we go on, because the original one of the courses teachings is that we are at one with God, and the truth of our existence is that we actually exist in oneness with God, and we've just forgotten that. We've just lost touch with.
Yeah.
We've separated psychologically in our minds from that experience, and the spiritual path is the journey back to that point that we'd actually never left.
Right.
But as we progress along that path, we're actually getting nearer to that point where we returning to that point where we split off. Now, that original split from God, the Course says, was a terrifying moment, because suddenly, you know, one moment we're sitting in heaven with God our Father, if you like to use that word, and the next moment we're not there, we're gone, we're somewhere else, we're here in the world, having totally forgotten that sense. And that's a moment of terror. It's like as if we've killed God and destroyed heaven. And it's a very dramatic moment. The Course is equivalent to the Big Bang. That created the whole physical universe, the Course says, and all going on within the mind. But it was a time of terror. I think it uses that phrase, that this was a time of terror. And so it is said that as we move back towards that point, we're going to re-experience that. Although we have help now. We have the help of the Holy Spirit to kind of hold our hand and guide us and comfort us and all the rest of it. But the challenges may appear to get greater as we go along. That's not to put people off, because we are heading home, and you know, what else is there to do but to head home to the place we never actually left. But well, I find that life is still full of challenges, and I mean, I've just been going through one in the last couple of days, really.
So that's really important for people to understand that, isn't it? Because so many people can get into these things and give the impression that it's changed everything around and it's sweeter than light. But I suppose what I notice is I have started to get snatches of that, you know, that absolute stillness and calmness. Very, very, very minute at the beginning. Yeah. But I think once you've had that experience, it never leaves you. And then presumably that gets bigger, and the turmoil... The instances of the turmoil maybe get less, do they? Even though the intensity may not.
Yes, I certainly get exactly what you said, snatches of great peace and bliss, and then the ego comes back to the fore again, and in fact, you know, it might come back with a vengeance. In a way, just kind of seize control again. I'm talking about the ego as if it's some malevolent force. it's only a part of my own mind, our own mind.
Yeah.
But that's how we experience it. It sort of gets back in control again until you have the next miracle, a shift in perception. Or what the Course calls a holy instant, which is like a momentary glimpse of the truth where we experience great peace and joy and so forth.
Yeah.
I think when I said about the Course giving me a new context for my life, maybe this is the point to say that, because when these difficulties occur in my life, when I'm faced with these problems or... My ego is having a field day, as it has been the last couple of days. I now see that as not as a problem, and this is some disaster that's happened. But I'm much more likely to see this as an opportunity.
Right. You've got that awareness then.
Yes. Yeah. So if I can see my problems as an opportunity for growth, an opportunity to learn a lesson, an opportunity to get closer back, closer to truth, closer to God, then the problem becomes a positive thing.
Yeah.
Something I can actually even welcome.
Yeah, but that's tough when you're in the middle of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is tough when you're in the middle of it. Yes, it takes faith and a bit of practice, I think. So when great things are happening, you can say, "Wow, that's great." And then when you're faced with difficulties and challenges, you can begin to say, "Wow, that's great too."
Yeah.
So that's the context, in that everything that happens is either great or everything happens is great.
There's no such thing as bad news.
For a purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's always for our growth, our highest growth, isn't it?
Hmm. Well, if we so choose it to be. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So rather than change the situation, it's about changing the way we're viewing it. Yeah.
Yeah. If a inverted commas disaster happens, some challenge you're facing, some problem, then the ego's in control, then I think it keeps you more kind of stuck in the world.
Absolutely.
But if you choose to let spirit be in charge, to have a miracle instead, then that very same situation is an opportunity to undo some issue in your own mind and to grow.
Right.
So the choice is yours. Which way do you want to use the situation to keep you more stuck or for your release?
Yeah.
And sometimes I do choose to use it to be more stuck.
Yeah.
Even after all these years of practice, because I think the ego is not to be underestimated. It's a powerful.
Well, it's vicious, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yeah. Marianne Williamson calls it a powerful gravitational field. It's like pulling you towards its way of thinking.
Yeah.
And I tend to think of it as like the default mode in computer speak. You know, you switch on your computer or something, it's in its default mode until you change the settings or whatever. So the ego is the default mode for human beings. Unless we choose against it. So you actually have to positively choose against the ego, choose something else.
Yeah.
Choose again. Otherwise, the ego, if you just get up in the morning and just do whatever you do, chances are the ego is in charge unless you choose against it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is tough, though, isn't it? At times, it's like when we're in that place. I mean, I also have had that kind of day and a bit, traveling a lot, with all the challenges that happens, with time zones and flight changes and delays and everything else. Mm. And then coming back in, and I think it is about recognizing that it's really going into fear, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because those are the two choices we have.
Right. Well, the ego will tell you that fear is justified, and fear is a sensible option, which of course it isn't, and so that's the choice that one makes between fear and love. Love is the choice of in that sort of these sort of situations we're talking about, of trust, of expansion rather than contractions, and the ego keeps one small and constricted.
Yeah. So now you'd got to this stage where you were importing Marianne's tapes and distributing those, and you'd started your own study group, your book study group. Then lead us on from there, Ian, if you would, to the formation.
Yeah.
Of the,
well, as I said, various people said to me, "Why don't you start a magazine?" And I said, no, it's far too much work. And then Robert Holden came along and said to me, "Why don't we start one?" So, and then I said yes, finally, because he used the we word. And I knew about his experience in publishing. So I said yes, and he then disappeared, but there was a couple of other people around who helped me to get the first issue out in 1994. And then we started organizing events on a small scale to start with, of course. And then this was in the very early days of the internet. I think probably 95 or 96. Some people came along and said, why don't, you know, we'll create a Miracle Network website for you. Now, I didn't even really know what the internet was at that point. I didn't know what a website was. But I said, yes, you know, why, if you guys want to do it, do it. So they created a website for us, and of course,
and at this time,
hard to imagine how I could do without it now.
Oh, absolutely! I mean, I think that's taken over the world, isn't it? The information technology.
Absolutely.
And at this time, presumably, apart from Chuck had already been over to Britain, I suppose, doing his psychology.
Yes, I think I first saw him.
But there'd be nobody from the
institute. 1988.
1988 was he when he first came over?
1988.
88. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about people like Ken Wapnick, the people that were there right at the beginning? Had they been over at all to do workshops and that sort of stuff, disseminating the material or not?
I think Marianne had been over as well before I even knew about her. She had, because I met people who had seen her here. Ken Wapnick came over, I think, in the late 80s or sometime in the 80s. But he hasn't been back since, as far as I know. We've certainly invited him quite a few times, and he always makes excuses for not coming. I mean, basically, he's getting on in life, and as we all are. And but I guess he's less willing to travel. I'd love to get him over, but I think he came in the 80s and did a couple of workshops.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we've had in my time running the Miracle Network, we've had, as well as Gary Renard, who you've mentioned, we've had Robert Perry over, Alan Watson, John Mundy, Dwayne O'Kane, a lady called Linda Bates, Pamela Calandrio, all kinds of Diane Burke.
I mean, it is fascinating how this wonderful work grows, isn't it? Because they've never done any sort of advertising per se, yet it's down to individuals, fantastic people like yourself that have taken it and really run with it, because I mean, you started with the magazine, and then when did you make this your full time? You know, that's the interesting part. When did you make that leap of saying, right, I'm letting go of the oil business?
Well, it was increasingly difficult to, as the network expanded, it was increasingly difficult to do two jobs, to effective full time jobs, and. I'm a bit of a coward, to be honest, and there was a moment when I got quite a large sum of money for doing a very small amount of work, and I thought, well, if I can do this just occasionally, then I can afford to give up working full-time in the oil industry and just and dedicate myself fully to the Miracle Network and just occasionally go off and do these high-paying jobs.
Yeah.
Specifically, why the opportunity that came along was to be an expert witness in a court case.
Right.
Using my expertise that I gained in the oil industry to be an expert witness, and it was very high paying. So I thought, well, I only need a few of these a year, and I'm laughing. The interesting thing is, I've never had a single job like that since. But it was enough to give me the impetus to give up the oil industry and to do the Miracle Network full time.
Okay. Well,
the benefit of hindsight, I think it's kind of interesting to look back and kind of almost see the hand of, you know, that this was kind of guided.
Absolutely.
The hand
totally
from above,
believe
you know, that.
That
this opportunity was presented to me, and without it, maybe I wouldn't have had the guts to let go of the.
I think you're being harsh on yourself there. It's a massive step to take. You know, I mean, as you know, I've come from the same industry, and I, You know, right. it was massive. But I also think, Ian, that this thing about commitment, I think commitment is a very powerful, I mean, there's that Scottish explorers that are saying that, you know, the minute one commits to anything, other forces come in, providence takes over. I think there were words to that effect, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely true. I think the power of commitment is just like when Judy Scutch and the original team, you know, Kenneth Wapnick and people, when they committed to actually publishing the course, the guy from New Mexico called in with the money the next day.
That's right. That's the example I was thinking of, actually, as you were saying that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So I think it says a lot for yourself. You committed. And I think that's a lot of encouragement to people who may be listening, that that gives us the courage to trust that the first thing is to commit. Because the minute we're wishy-washy about anything, and I can look back on my own life and see things, projects that I've sort of I've not been too sure about, you know, and of course the result, net result is nothing.
Mm. I agree with you. Well, I was going to say, but I also see that there was that sort of hand from above guiding things, I think. I really feel that quite strongly, that it was strange to me in the early 90s that people were saying to me, why don't you start a Course in Miracles newsletter, for example? Several people said that to me. Why would they think I would do that? I had no experience of writing or publishing.
No.
And it was almost like it was the purpose of that. Like, they were sent from central casting, as Mary Williamson said, to sow these seeds in my mind so that I did eventually go off and do that thing that I didn't want to do. I kept saying no, far too much work.
Yeah,
that was the excuse I used. I think I was right in that, actually. But
Did Robert Holden get involved with you in the end?
He did. Yeah. Although he was very busy, and as I say, he disappeared for the first 6 months. He did come back on board, and he was editorial advisor for quite a number of years. But he's still a good friend, and every time we have a conference, Robert's one of the regular speakers, presenters at those conferences.
Right.
Yeah.
So how did it develop then?
Pardon?
How did it develop into the meetings and then then you started to... Because, I mean, you really are a teacher of the course as well. I mean, I know that I know the concept that everyone's both student and teacher, but when did you start to do workshops and all that kind of stuff?
Well, again, it never occurred to me that I would be that I would formally teach. I was writing for the Miracle Worker magazine. I felt that as editor, I should make some contribution. But I never saw myself as teaching classes or workshops or anything like that. But again, it was suggested to me by other people, and Robert Holden. That he really felt that it was very strongly that it should be something that it was something I should be doing, and other people as well. And
did you sort of did you draw these up formally, or did you just go with the, you know, that piece in the course that you know, that where you say those few words beforehand about, you know, being guided by the Holy Spirit and kind of what the layman might say, did you wing it, or did you structure them and sort of?
No, I actually inherited a workshop from somebody else who'd been teaching a workshop at an adult education establishment in London. A lady by the name of Nicola Harvey, who's now married to Robert Perry, but she's now Nicola Perry. She was teaching at the centre in London, and I forget the reasons now. I think, yes, because she was moving to America. She had to give that up. This was in the late 90s, I think it was about 98. So she recommended to them that I take over these classes. Now, she'd already set out a formal teaching schedule for the weekend. So I just took that over, and I adapted it a little bit to my own ends and added some material that I'd gathered along the way. But 50% of it was, I suppose, Nicola's template. And that's how that started.
Right.
So there were weekend workshops. I taught weekly classes before that. I've forgotten that.
Weekly classes?
yeah, a 10-week series of classes at one point, and then that was short to an eight-week series of classes. So the material from those classes got included in this weekend template of Nicola's. So that's an amalgamation of the two things. But yeah, it was very much a formal structure. I find that works for me. Yeah, I know what you're saying about going in with an empty slate and you know, knowing that I will be guided, and that certainly happens as well. But I have the program written down, so I have a basic structure for the weekend. So it's not a formless weekend. But then within each of those sort of headings, so if I'm an hour on forgiveness or something, I find I'm very much guided within that hour around that subject.
Yeah,
and I do.
But
I do
you had a kind of a rough framework.
Yeah. I know some people don't need to do that, but I find that works for me.
Yeah, well, it's very much an individual thing, isn't it? I think that's the beauty, and when people do what works for them, that's when the participants kind of resonate with that, don't they?
Yeah, and you could never plan a workshop in its entirety, because you never know what's going to happen. A lot of the teaching actually comes from the participants, what they bring to the group, and the questions that get asked, and the contributions they make. So, within that basic structure, you still have to be on your toes to deal with what the participants bring.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you, Ian, is what your feeling is, as somebody that's taught this work now for many, many years, is this question about the need to go and do lower sort of healing stuff. Do you feel that by doing the course, by doing the forgiveness lessons, doing all the workbook lessons and everything else, do you think that is, if they're done diligently, that actually does the job of healing the lower self as well, or do you feel
How
that,
do you mean the lower healing?
Well, I mean the emotional memories, etc., that we may have, negative experiences, although, the more you get into the course changes your mind about them all and makes you realize eventually that they never happened and all that stuff. That's pretty high stuff to go to. What I'm really saying is, do you subscribe to that it's okay or even advisable to sort of get some therapeutic help or something to do emotional release work, or do you feel that by doing the course diligently that takes care of all that?
Well, I think the most sensible thing is to do what works. You know, I think conventional therapy definitely works. Emotional release works to a degree. I think rather than walking around with bottled up emotions, if it helps you to go and scream and shout, beat pillows or whatever, then I know people who do that and it seems to work. I would say, though, as a proviso to that, that anger, whatever the emotion is, has a cause, and that cause is in one's thoughts, and so it's a cause and effect. You have to, in order to deal with the effect, the anger, you actually have to go back and treat the cause, which is the thinking. I always liken it to if you've got a leaking pipe or some leaking tap or something, a dripping tap, you put a bucket under the tap to catch the water. Well, unless you fix the leak, change the washer on the tap or whatever it is, you'll be emptying out the bucket forever in a day. You've got to go back and sort out the cause of the leak. So you could be beating pillows for the rest of your life, trying to release your anger, but you never will succeed in doing that if you don't go back to the cause, which is your thoughts, and heal those. And then the anger will automatically be dealt with.
Yeah.
That would really be the causative approach.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because the course actually says, doesn't it, that anger is actually never justified.
Right. Right. With its
whereas
way.
In typical psychotherapeutic work, you know, we're always taught, you know, there's righteous anger, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
yeah.
a term that's actually used.
Well,
you know, that
there are rather more sophisticated Course in Miracles trained therapists around. I've been to a couple of them myself, who don't say that your anger is justified and validate that as a legitimate experience. So they do attempt to help you through it, to see it differently.
Yeah.
And the reason why your anger is never justified is it's a projection of something from one's past onto a current situation.
Yes.
So you actually got. So the miracle will take you back. One of the things the miracle will do will take you back and heal the belief that one has, which has been brought into the present time from the past.
Right. Okay. So that's what one of the meanings of the miracle is. So that the miracle is totally okay with acknowledging going back and healing the original pain, if you like.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
If you heal the situation in front of you, it will have an effect through time. The miracle is no respecter of time and space. So it has a cumulative kind of knockback effect through other dimensions, actually, and the Course says that it can touch times and places of which you're totally unaware. But certainly, you could, if you have whether it applies to former lives, if we believe in former lives, I don't know, but it may well do. But certainly in this life, if I've got an issue that began when I was a child because my mother abandoned me or something, and I experience situations in my current life of abandonment, or what I see as abandonment. In fact, I might as well just talk about what does happen. That is one of the things that happens in my life. Not that my mother abandoned me, but there was a situation in my life where I felt abandoned, and that is one of my core issues. And people
right.
say I've got an arrangement to see someone and they cancel, that will bring up my abandonment issue. What the Course would suggest that I do is to forgive the person in front of me who's just cancelled my lunch date or whatever it is, and it's like layers of an onion. If I deal with that, the breaking of the lunch date, then that peels off another layer of the onion. I keep doing that every time that same issue presents itself or any other issue, and the onion gets smaller and smaller until it goes back and will eventually heal the original cause of that issue, which was whatever I believe my mother did to me. Not that she really did abandon me, but it was a belief that I took on. If that makes sense. Are you there?
Yes.
Hello?
I say totally.
Oh, sorry.
Hello.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm still here, Ian. Yeah. Yeah, and I think this is the part, and I think the other thing that, if I understand it correctly, the Course is not saying, it's not saying that we deny our emotions, because I think that's a mistake which I certainly made at the beginning, was to think that it meant I hadn't got to feel anything. But I don't think that's true at all, is it?
Yeah, like you said, when the Course says anger is ever justified, that doesn't mean to say that you're not going to feel angry. And if you do feel angry, you should pretend you're not, because, I mean, after all, I'm a Course student, I shouldn't be angry. Which is the sort of thing a lot of people do think and say to themselves or say to others. Shouldn't be angry, I'm a Course student. You have to, if you're feeling angry, you're feeling angry. But it's useful information. There's something going on. There's some thought pattern that's created this anger.
Yeah, that's
right?
It.
And if you deny that you're feeling
I mean, right?
it, then you're denying yourself the opportunity of healing that.
Yeah.
So it's very counterproductive to try and pretend that you're not feeling what you're feeling.
No, so if I can clarify that, so really what I think I'm hearing you say then is it's about acknowledging what you're feeling, but the fact, if you're studying the course, what hopefully it'll do is it'll stop you from actually acting out and projecting that outside, that you'll feel it, become aware of it, and do something about it without dropping into, you know, attacking somebody else over it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And obviously we're going to do that from time to time as well.
Yeah, you may project it onto somebody else if you don't catch it early enough. But potentially, yes, it allows you to stop yourself. As soon as you notice, you know, that kind of twinge of pain or twinge of disturbance or whatever it is, it'll give you a means of dealing with it and coming back to truth and harmony and peace.
Yeah.
But it takes practice and sometimes we get it wrong.
Yeah.
Sometimes we mess up. Sometimes we do attack. I've been known to attack people even in the last few years, you know.
Yeah.
And then you come to self-forgiveness when you realize you've done, because when you attack someone, you feel bad. It increases.
Sure.
When I attack someone, it increases my sense of guilt and shame.
Yeah.
So then that
gives, I think that's one of the lovely things which I found very simple about the course was the understanding, not saying that's easy, but simple, very big difference between those two. But the far part that I found was simple was if I held into the memory as much as I can that whatever I'm doing to another, I'm actually doing it to myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a kind of a good way to, and even then I can still go out like, it's an amazing.
The great thing about that idea that whatever we do to others, we're doing to ourselves, is we can turn that around and we can say, you know, when we treat other people with love and respect and kindness, etc., then we get that ourselves. We're treating ourselves with love and respect and kindness.
Absolutely.
So it's wonderful.
Absolutely.
Whatever the course says, to give and receive are one.
Yes.
Whatever we put out there, we get back in bucket loads.
Yeah. Ian, you know, it's almost incredible. I can't believe how the time's gone tonight. You know, we're almost up to 10 to the hour, and we need to sort of wrap up just before the hour, just after 5:02. Right. And I wanted quickly, if I may, just to say or get you to say a little bit about the fact that the awareness of the course has really exploded since Gary Renard's book, The Disappearance of the Universe. I know that I found, in my case, you know, I had got the course sitting on my bookshelf for somewhere in the region of 7 years, and rather like yourself, was a bit put off by its Christian terminology and what have you. Even though I'd tried to get in and I'd gone to a couple of study groups, I just really didn't get it. And with Gary's book coming out, I think that really took me to... Are you finding that as well amongst people coming to your groups in London?
We have found that a lot in the last 3 or 4 years, that a huge number of people have come as a result of Gary Renard's books, particularly the first one, The Disappearance of the Universe. It's not a new phenomenon, though. I think a wider perspective on that is that I think over the years there's been three books primarily that have really brought the course to a wider awareness. The first one, which I think was about 25, 26 years ago now, was Jerry Jampolsky's book, Love is Letting Go of Fear. And that was huge in, so when was it now? Well, in the 80s. And then in the early 90s, Marianne Williamson's book, Return to Love.
Return to Love.
Huge. Yeah. And there was a great increase in awareness and interest in the course as a result of that. And then in, was it 2002, 2003, Gary Renard's Disappearance of the Universe has had the same effect. So I think it's really the third in a line of books that have had a similar effect, but it's the one that probably we remember most because it's the most recent.
Yeah.
It's been brilliant, and I really salute Gary and the others, for what they've done, really, in increasing awareness of the Course in Miracles.
Yeah, I think that all those three that you mentioned, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have been led to those myself, and it is remarkable, and they do a wonderful job, because I think they, you know, I think the course, I mean, its actual physicalness. I was talking to Patrick Miller, D. Patrick Miller, about this. You know, the actual physicalness of the book doesn't lend anybody. He was telling me about when it first came out, they did a, when Penguin first took it, I think it was Penguin, wasn't it? They did a big promotional, you know, thing in the stores. And of course, you know, Patrick was saying he was watching people, and they just didn't get drawn to it because physically it's not, it's, you know, it's got no pictures on, it's got nothing at all about it. But it's amazing.
Well, like I said, I was repelled by it when I first saw it. It was partly because of the language, partly because of the size of it and the density of it. Yeah. It would be great to have a Course in Miracles with pictures, wouldn't it?
No, but it's... Well, what is it known how many are in circulation now, Ian?
Well, let me think. I think we're talking something like 1.5 million copies have been
sold. 1.5 million copies, all around.
I suppose not all of them are in circulation at the moment. Yeah, it's now out in a dozen or more, maybe even 15 languages, ranging from Russian and Chinese to Spanish and German.
It's amazing.
And a lot of East European languages now as well, and Greek and Swedish and all sorts. So, yes, including all those. It's at least 1.5 million copies.
It's funny how it's quite parallel to the story of the Big Book of AA in a way, you know. You know, a lot of people from 12-step, you know, the 12-step community get to the Course in Miracles. I certainly came to it, you know. And it's an interesting parallel, that how that first started, you know, in 1935 and then spread and then translated into many languages. A very similar thing.
I don't actually know anything about the Big Book of AA, but I do know the principles of the 12 steps are very much in alignment with the principles of the Course in Miracles. And there's a beautiful book called Side by Side, which is only costs about, I don't know, $5 or $6 or something, and it sets out the principles of the course side by side with the 12 steps of
AA. That's interesting. That's interesting. So you said there's actually a book out called Side by Side.
Called Side by Side by, who's it by? Bette Martin and Cundiff, C-U-N-D-I-F-F, or something like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
But people can Google
it
if they're interested. I'm trying to find a copy here, but I can't find it.
Side by Side, anyway, that's a great
one. Side by Side,
The 12 step, But even the physicalness, you know, the 12, the Big Book of AA is like the same color, dark blue. It must be something about this, you know.
Really?
And all it's got, it's not even embossed in gold. It's just embossed. It's embossed into the cover. The Big Book without any gold painting on it or anything, and very bland looking, with no pictures and no author, of course.
Mm.
So. It's a very similar thing, and a lot of people. Yeah. And I've heard somebody say that the Course in Miracles is like a graduate course for 12 steppers, which I thought was a nice way of putting it, you know.
Yes.
So, what plans do you have for the future, Ian?
I think the best way of answering that question is, well, I know what's happening the rest of this year, pretty much, because we've set a few things up. We've got a conference coming up in October. The UK conference.
Oh, that's the UK conference. Would you like to tell listeners there? Because there'll be a lot of people from the UK listening in.
Yes, well, probably the best place to find information on it is on our website, if I might give that address out.
Yeah, please
do. The whole page on the conference, which is... let me get the dates for you. It's October the... Saturday the 18th and Sunday the 19th of October. Called Being the Light. It's the 10th Course in Miracles Conference, UK's 10th Course in Miracles Conference. But if they go to our website, which is www.miracles.org.uk, all the details are there.
Okay, www.miracles.org.uk.
Okay. Yeah, and we've got Gary Renard coming in May. He's doing a Friday evening on the 16th of May, Saturday, the 17th of May, that's a full day. In London, and Sunday the 18th of May, a full day in Birmingham for the UK people. We've got Newt Sanchez and Thomas Vieira coming in June. They're the authors of this latest best-selling book, which has also caused quite a stir, actually, called Take Me to Truth, Undoing the Ego. Very practical, practical book. And lots of other things happening, too. This year. Looking further ahead than this year, I don't know, actually. I'm prepared to be guided as I have been to date.
I think that's the wonderful thing about it. And we are just coming up to the end, Ian, and I want to acknowledge you publicly for the work you've done for this course in this country, and I know you speak also at the international conference. And if anybody wants to come along, I can really tell you that they're wonderful evenings. They're held at the Miracle Cafe. Is that right, the last Thursday of the month?
Last Thursday of the month, yeah. They're just little evenings of fun and social, and people can just dip in if they're not really sure, or just come along and make new friends. Yeah, that information's on our website as well.
As well. Good. Lovely. Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for giving up your time, and thank you especially
for
readjusting to that change.
Yeah, no problem at all. It's been good fun. Thank you very much, John.
All right. Thanks, Ian. All the best. God bless.
Bye.
Bye-bye.